Everyone's on that. How was everyone? Doing well? Looking good? Feeling amazing? And another dose. All right, let's begin then. Let's bring our palms together. Make our veneration to the Supremely Enlightened One, the Perfect One. The Unvanquished One, the Undefeated One. As we make this mark and token of respect, let us also remind ourselves that this is not a mere mark of our obeisance, but a pledge of our allegiance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. The Buddha, which represents the truth, the Dhamma, the path, and the Sangha, our practice. These three are the three pillars that one needs to get themselves across the ocean of suffering onto the land of happiness. And that is what we are all here for. So with that in mind, let us take this opportunity to seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. Observe the precepts, which will be our guide to get us to our destination. Let us also then invite the countless sentient beings to join us and witness this meritorious deed. For among them may be those who are lacking in merit, and may this serve as them as an opportunity to rejoice in these merits as they witness this wonderful gathering of righteous individuals here to achieve their liberation. And for all sentient beings who are in the blissful plane and who are within earshot of this sermon, may they join us and listen to this teaching such that they may attain the ultimate bliss of Nibbana, just as you and I do. And with all that said and done, let us begin with today's sermon. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. You say, "Om," now I know what you'll be saying in a minute. Be careful what you wish for. Wouldn't it be nice if everyone, each and every one of you had a remote? So you could all control the aircon? These ACs will be, they'll just go crazy because one will be turning it up, the other will be turning it down. My advice to you is to try and become someone who doesn't need to have the remote in their hand. Everyone likes to have the remote in their hand, to be in control. When you have a remote in your hand, what are you trying to do? Change. Change what? Yourself? Then? Others. So it's called a remote control. If you're trying to change yourself, how can it be remote? It'll be local control. But you feel a sense of power, don't you, when you have a remote in your hand? Even at home, typically in our culture, who's the one who takes the remote? The who? Well, I don't know about your home, but where I used to grow up, it was always Appaji who had the remote control. He decided what we would watch on TV. He was the head of the family. So the head of the family gets the remote. He decides and we watch. It didn't matter whether we were in the middle of some really interesting movie or some kind of a drama or some really interesting program. When he decided that he'd had enough, he would change. So I used to sit by his side and think, one day. One day will come when I will have that in my hand. And then I will decide what we watch. See, we all have this voice, this internal voice that says, oh, how I wish I had the remote. Now, if you are the boss, the top man, or the top lady in your company, wouldn't it be nice if you had a remote for every person that worked in the company? Yeah. If they talk too much, you turn it down. If they're not contributing in a meeting, they remain mute. But you want them to say something, they won't speak up. Then take the remote and turn them out. If they're late, again you take the remote and get them to come early. So it feels like you have power when you have the remote. And the world will praise you. If you work yourself up the ladder and somehow get hold of that remote, the world will praise you. And they'll say, well done, they'll congratulate you. See, he's got the remote, she's got the remote. So there's one man in our country who has a remote for the entire country. So these top men in all of these countries, they're trying to negotiate, shall we put it that way, with each other, have friendly discussions to try and get the remote for other countries as well. Oh, how I'm sure they wish that they could have a remote to the entire world. Because the feeling is that when you have a remote, you're in control. But little do they realize that the need to have control is a bigger curse than not having the remote control. That is the problem. For all their education, for all their authority, for all their knowledge and wisdom, the fact that they have forgotten this simple principle, the fact that there's the need to have the remote in your hand, that is the problem. How easily that is forgotten and ignored. So, you know, in your homes, in every community, there's a remote, there's someone with the remote. Because there's always a competition as to who gets the remote. In a community where there's ego, so this is only true for communities where there's ego. Where there is no ego, then the last thing you want is a remote. Because with great power comes what? Indeed. Great responsibility. So in your homes, someone will have the remote. Maybe sometimes you are kind enough to share it with someone else. But you only hand the remote over, provided when you want it back, they will hand it back to you. So actually when you give the remote, you keep another remote. That remote controls what happens to the other remote. Yeah? So that this remote controller you don't give to anyone. Fathers, husbands, typically, I talk about our culture, typically in our culture, in our households, that is usually the case. In other cultures it might be different. But either way, you know, see, in communities where typically the man has the remote, you will find pockets of women fighting. It's a struggle. A struggle for power. They want to be able to do what? Get the remote into their hand. So this is what you have in some cultures, some setups. This is so, where men have superiority or so-called superiority. These are all conventions. When men have conventional superiority, you'll have women who will struggle to be in possession of the remote. So they will say, why can't we also have the remote? If you can, why can't we? What opportunities are they called? Equal opportunities. Basically what they're saying is, if you can suffer, why can't we? Isn't it? If you can suffer, why can't we? We also have every right to suffer. See, I don't see that as fighting for women's rights. It's not siding with women. My task or our task is a very different one. Speak to Anagarika Mahatmyas. Ask them whether they demand equal rights. You talk to them when you see them. Ask them whether they demand equal rights. Is that what they're fighting for? The right to have an equal place with men? That's not what they're fighting for. They're fighting for freedom. Freedom from that feeling. Not freedom for an equal platform. Freedom for that compelling urge for that platform. Because this fight you can never win. The fight that you see around the world to try and get on equal level, that fight can never be won. Because there are always two parties to this. And neither of them want to win. Sorry, neither of them want to lose. They both want to win. And when you have a sense of ego, it's not you who makes these decisions. Your ego makes these decisions. It pushes you, it compels you. And an ego always wants to feel superior. It is characteristic of an ego. So what can you do about it? If you step out into the hot sun, can you stop yourself from burning? Can you? It's not your choice anymore, is it? Once you step outside, it's going to burn. It's going to scorch you. It's not your choice anymore. In the same manner, well, let me give you another example. If you step out in the rain, then you're going to get wet. It's not your choice anymore. I mean, ignore, you could hold an umbrella, but put that to a side for a second. If you step out in the sun, you're going to get burnt. If you step out in the rain, you're going to get wet. Right? So the only real choice you have is not to step out. To step out or not to step out. That is the question. But when you choose to step out, if the sun's out, you're going to burn. If the rain's out, you're going to get wet. In the same way, if you end up with an ego, then whatever is characteristic of an ego, you're going to have to put up with. It's not your choosing after that. That's why I always say, bad people aren't bad. They don't choose to be bad. It's part of the ego. The other day I talked about ticks. Not the little insects, but ticks as a medical condition. So if you have ticks, is it in your control? The way you behave, the things you say, sometimes your physical features and how your body responds to certain stimuli. It's not, right? It's part of that. If you had a cough, remember I used to bring one here every Sunday for a long time. Yeah? You wanted the sermon. So I came here with the cough. Was it in my control when to cough and when not to? Was it? No. So once you have it, it is characteristic of that cough for me to be generating sounds or vibrations, keep it simple, for me to be making these sounds, which, of course, that's not what you're here for. You don't like it. I don't like it either. But, I mean, they're not very pleasant to listen to, but what can we do about it? When you feel a tingly sensation in your nose or in your mouth or whatever, and then you feel like sneezing, right? It's only a matter of time before you're going to have to let it all out. And if you've got snot in your nose at the time, then, you know, the worst is when it comes when you're eating, right? And there's food in your mouth. As I have it, you've got food, your mouth full of food, and now you want to sneeze. Because you know if you block it, it might go up down the wrong pipe, and then you'll have to suffer. The people who fear the most when you feel like, you know, you start showing these signs that you're going to sneeze, right? You have a telltale sign of, there's one brewing, one's on the way. So people who get worried the most are the people who are sat around you. Right? So while you're charging yourself up for a sneeze, you see people getting up from the dining table and stepping back a few, taking a few steps back, because they know it's coming. What can you do? Do you see, of course, with a sneeze, it's characteristic that you're going to blow. All this wind will have to come out of your system, and whatever is in the way, it's going to push it all out. Now, there's no choice. That is characteristic of a sneeze. Does a sneeze check whether there's people in the vicinity? No. What if you're at work, you're having a business meeting, and there are clients you're trying to impress? You sat down for a meal, you're trying to impress some clients to get them to sign a deal with you, and in the middle of your meal, now you have a sneeze and there's food in your mouth. Now what do you do? If you had a napkin, fine, right? You put it against your mouth and try and somehow control it. But if not, then you're done. What can you do? What can you do? So in the same way, when you have ego, right, you're helpless. That's why I don't have a grudge or anything against people who are evil, who are unkind, who are vile or vicious, who are bad, so-called bad people, who have jealousy, lust, desire, greed. Because this is not their doing. It's what ego does. Ego is the culprit, not the human. It's not the mind that's the culprit. If I put something really hot in your hand, what are you going to do? Typically, you're going to drop it, aren't you? What if it was something really precious? Imagine I gave something to you, it's fragile. How can I told you this is worth $1 billion, right? But it's incredibly hot. And I gave it to you. What would you do with it? And there, you can't pass it to anyone. There's no one else around you. Your immediate reaction is going to be what? To drop it. Because that is how it is. It's not your fault for doing that. So in the same way, you know, you're all forgiven. I forgive you. You're all forgiven. For all your sins, you are forgiven. So you can relax now. You're all forgiven for all your sins, all your past sins, all those burdens in your mind, all those worries you have, all those regrets that you have to carry, the burden of regret. All those times where you did things that you shouldn't have done. For all that you are forgiven, because it wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault. If you are laden with ego, then this is what happens. Nothing you can do about it. That is where we try and find freedom. How do we free ourselves from our egos? Freedom is to be found there, ladies and gentlemen. Typically what people do is they keep their ego, and when they're with their ego, they have all these things that they want from the external world, either from other people or from other things, from other situations. Right? They want something from their country. They want something from their community. They want something from their family. They want something from their workplace. They want something from their friends. Right? We can make a long list of things you want from everyone around you and everything around you. If you plant a tree at home, what do you want from it? Say a mango tree. Right? You work really hard to plant a mango tree. Okay, now it's done. In a few years' time, what do you want from it? Nothing. Mangoes, of course. Whose fault is that? See, you don't see anything problem. There's no problem with that, do you? Is there? We don't tend to see a problem with that. It seems very natural. We plant a mango seed and you expect mangoes from it. What's so wrong with that? The tree yielding mangoes is fine. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you wanting mangoes. Pinsit Deva. So that's a kind reminder for everyone. If you have your phone on you, then kindly put it on mute. And the other thing is, sometimes we bring these bottles and they're metal. So when metal collides with ceramic, right, it tends to make a vibration. And those vibrations, they travel across the room. And sometimes there are people who are sat next to the bottle and they start flying and they go hit the ceiling. Just startled by the noise of all that. So if you have a bottle, especially a metallic bottle, and it's by your feet, I suggest you move it just to the side, not in front of the other person's feet. Because otherwise you just end up knocking it down and then it's just going to stir everyone up. And for a moment, it's going to stir people up. And that's going to break their samadhi. That is why I say to be careful about it. Remember the two things that we need? What? Merit and attention, concentration. Without concentration, it's difficult to understand. Especially when we start talking about really deep things, like what we talked about last week. So you need that concentration. So when that concentration breaks, it takes a while to come back to that. By that point, I'm already continuing from where we stopped. Because I know what I wanted to say, whereas you don't know what I'm going to say. Therefore, if your train of thought breaks, it derails, it takes a little bit of work to get you back in there. So it's possible that someone here is about to attain their next margapala, the next attainment, noble attainment. But if that is interrupted by a sound, then in vain, right? Now they have to work again, which we all have to, but in vain. So these are little things we have to just be mindful of. So phones, anything that makes a noise, if you have a bag with you that when you move around it makes a big noise, then it's best to just bring something that doesn't make a lot of noise. Or if that is all you have, then keep it safely to a side so that it doesn't mark your presence. It marks your presence. Right? And bottles in the room go, she's here. But even after all this is said, typically in every sermon, somewhere something will happen. And if it does, then what do we all do? We give them the evil eye. Right? We look at them and go, you just mumble a swear at them, right? And give them the evil eye. You look them up and down, right? Is that what we're supposed to do? No. If that is what you really want to do, you're again someone who wants a remote control. See? Don't be the one who needs the remote control. Sometimes people will give it to you, then take it. If it's given to you, right, then if that's as part of a natural process, if the remote control is given to you, then take it. You don't have to reject it. Take it if it's given to you, but don't go looking for it. This going looking for it is a disease of the mind. The need to be in control. And society will always tell you otherwise. That's why in society, some people are wise. Some are otherwise. So it might it depends on who you wish to associate with, right? You've got to pick your crowd. But if you're not careful about the crowd you associate with, then they will fill you up with everything that's in their head. If they have the good stuff, then they will share with you the good stuff. If their head is full of kaka, then what will you end up with? The same. So people will always encourage you to go after control, as was once done with me. Seek a position of authority, seek positions of power, seek positions of influence. As a monk, right now I am in such a position, but this is not a position I want to be in necessarily. If someone puts me here on this seat, I will speak. If in the middle of this discourse someone says, enough Swami, enough, you can get up and leave, then I will respectfully accept your invitation. See, they are both invitations to me. The invitation to come and sit here, as well as the invitation to get up and leave. They're both invitations. One is, it's not that one's an invitation and the other's an insult. It's not like that. They're both invitations. So then I will get up, mark my respect at the feet of the Buddha, and then I shall leave. See, the problem with this need to be in control is this. This is why I talk against it. I encourage you to be free from the need to be in control. And this is difficult in our culture, especially for men. It's difficult. Not that it's any easier for the women. Because women folk are always inspired and motivated and told that they should work themselves up to be equals with men. So in them, there's always a fight for that, a struggle for that. Whereas the men enjoy a so-called privilege. It's typical of our culture. In some parts of the world, it's changing. But I want you to look through this fog of delusion and identify what true freedom is. True freedom is not to have the remote control in your hand. True freedom is to not have the need to have the remote control in your hand. Otherwise, people will just giddy you up. They will. It's fine to be inspired and motivated to climb up a ladder, but make sure that it's leaned against the right wall. Otherwise, you might end up in the wrong place. See, if you go back many years, when we had the war in our country, right? A lot of young men and young girls, they were recruited. Both sides. I'm not taking a side here. Because both sides are mine. That's why. I stand for humanity. And if it's a human on that side and a human on this side, then they're both mine. But young boys, young girls, they were taught, they were motivated, they were inspired. Nationalism was one thing that they often got talked about. Heritage. History. and racial supremacy. These kind of things were put into their heads, not just in our country, but in, this is how it happens most of the time. The way it works is people get together in some boardroom somewhere, people who have the means to make money and have the need to make money. What they do is they sit in boardrooms, right, and they discuss, how can we infiltrate these young minds and give them an eternal itch? This is an eternal itch. Nationalism is an eternal itch. The other one is religion. It's an eternal itch because both nationalism and religion are usually things that are placed on a very high pedestal. See, there's a national anthem, isn't there? That's because nationalism is given a huge place in society. There's a national anthem. There's an anthem for a nation. Just think about it. Do you have an anthem? When you were born, all they sang was what? Happy birthday to you, right? Everyone gets the same thing. All they do is just change the name. So when someone sings happy birthday to you, it's not, you don't feel special. The only part you feel special is when they put the name in there. But the national anthem, it's very special. See, a nation has an anthem. What else does a nation have? The flag. A nation has a flag. Then a nation has an emblem. Then there's a national bird. There's a national animal. There's a national dress. There's a national music. There's a national culture. All of these things are identified and recognized as national, shall we say, assets. Each and every one of these things, they work in people's hearts and minds to value nationalism and nationality. So nationalism is an idea that's very easy to actually give into someone's mind. To have a passion for your nationality and to care deeply about it. Now I want you to listen to this and take this in the way in which I intended. Okay, this is not an insult or anything like that. And I know that this talk is not going to change anything. Are we here to change the world? No. I'm only here to heal those who have come to this clinic. That's all. This is a clinic for the sick, mentally sick. Actually, this is a clinic for those who have accepted that they're mentally sick. What about the others? They haven't accepted that yet. They think they're sane. So that's nationalism on one side, and the other side is religion. Again, a religion, they have, it's an institution. And there's a lot of work, there's a lot of money, there's a lot of respect that goes into that. Religion usually demands and receives a lot of respect. Any religion, you name it, you know, it demands a lot of respect. Now when you drive past the Temple of the Tooth, if you are in a bus, public transport, even if you're in your own private vehicle, what do you tend to do? You raise yourself up in your seat, right? It's something that our grandparents have taught us, our parents have taught us. We do that. So likewise, I'm sure, there are people of other religions who would do the same. Perhaps when you drive in front of a mosque, maybe that's what Muslims do. And if you're a Christian, maybe that's what Christians do. As they drive in front of a famous church, a church which they feel brings them a lot of blessings, maybe that is a tradition that they have. Because religion demands and receives a lot of respect. Therefore, when you associate yourself with religion, with nationality, these are both anchors, and it's really interesting and really tasty and delicious food for the ego. If you're not careful. Especially religion. Because religion is brought in to kill the ego. If you take Buddhist philosophy, now Buddhist religion is the cover around Buddhist philosophy. So I don't know about Buddhism as a religion much, but I know a little bit about Buddhist philosophy. Buddhist philosophy is here to help kill the ego. But if people are not careful, they'll make a religion around it and an institution around it, and then use that to pump up the ego. It can be so bad, ladies and gentlemen, that sometimes you even come into robes to kill your ego and then forget why you came in there in the first place. And then you're caught in the stride and you forget. The very place where you have come to kneel down and kill your ego might also serve as a place where you end up with the biggest ego on the planet. If you're not careful. Because religion receives a lot of respect. You see, when I walk into this room, if you are sat down, what would you normally do? You'd stand up. If you offer something to me, what do you normally do? You give it to me. How do you give it to me? Here, take it. Is that how you do it? No. You normally do it with both hands. Sometimes you don't give that respect to your mother or father even. On that point, I encourage you to do that from here on. At least to your teachers, your mother and your father. These three individuals in your lives. Who are the three? Teachers, mother, father. Whenever you give them something, whenever you hand something over to them, what's the best way to do it? With both hands. Do it with both hands. Not for their sake, but for yours. These are things I learn in the sasana. So you're getting insight of the sasana without even coming into the sasana. Now at our monastery, when we hand things over to people, it doesn't matter whether you're a senior or a junior, because our respect is not to the individual, it's to what they represent. It doesn't matter to me whether someone's senior or junior, even if I hand something over to an Anagarika Mahatma. You ask anyone you see, or to a noble heart, little kid, little boy, little girl, or even to one of you. I'm saying this now, but you check whether when I give you something, if I hand something over to you, whether I do it in one hand. If I do it with one hand, you will see my other hand holding the other in this way. Perhaps if it's a small item, therefore you don't need both hands, right? If I hand this over to you this way, with my other hand, I'll be holding that hand. It's an offering. So it doesn't matter that I'm a monk and you're a lay person. I'm not superior just because I'm a monk. And you're not inferior just because you're a lay individual. That is not where we draw the line. That's not how the universe decides whether something or someone is superior or inferior. It is to the extent to which you have become the universe. And how do you become the universe? By giving up yourself. The universe is the inverse of oneself. Where did that come from? Whatever you are, or whatever you think you are, the inverse of that is the universe. You know what the inverse is, right? So in math, we learn it how? If this is x, what is the inverse of x? 1 over. Think about these things. This effort is to free ourselves from the need to be in control. In fact, if people could assimilate as these concepts as much as possible, you know, here I see solutions to many of the world's problems, ladies and gentlemen. We talked about the ongoing, people call it war. You know, we redefined what this is. It's not a war. It is demerit coming to fruition. We can call it a war, but this is demerit coming to fruition. Somewhere in that conversation, in that discussion, will be the need to be in control. Somewhere, I don't know where, but somewhere there's going to be the need to be in control. What I was saying was, people don't realize that there are meetings that take place behind closed doors in some undisclosed locations where people who wish to remain in control, they get together. These are the so-called people who control the world and how things work there. They plan how they can infiltrate into people's, young people's minds, because they have young blood. But by young blood, we mean inexperienced. That's what young blood means, inexperienced. They don't know what the aftermath of war can do. They don't know what this feeling of nationality, especially when it's mixed with aggression, what it can do. They don't know the aftermath or the consequence of conflict. But therefore they are prime. They are prime for this kind of priming. And they discuss in these meeting rooms how they can use media, how they can use the newspapers, how they can use social media, mass media, and take messages of nationalism, religion, race. All of these things are things that are very close to one's ego. That's what I mean. These are all hooks. And anyone who has an ego is vulnerable to this. The sad part of the story is, there's nothing you can do about it. If you want, you can try this out as an experiment, right? If you really want, if you don't believe what I say, you can try this out as an experiment. Whatever religion you are, right? Assume that you're a Hindu. Get someone who's a non-Hindu, say take a friend you know, a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Christian or someone, and get them to insult Hinduism in your presence. Just the two of you, get them to sit down, and then they say all these foul things about the Hindu gods and the Hindu religion, right, and all those things, and get them to say it in front of you and see how it makes you feel. Try it out for size. Maybe best to try your hands behind your back or the seat or something, so that, you know, in the spur of the moment, you're not inflamed, and then you have a massive attack at them, right? And also maintain some distance. Another thing you can do is, if you are a woman, get a man to sit in front of you. That's an easy one, because you have, we're used to that one. If you're a man, get a woman to do that. If you're a woman, get a man to do that. And, you know, get them to go as low as possible. Like, tell, get them to say all these bad, terrible, evil things about women and undermine them in your presence and see how that makes you feel. Then you realize that the disease is still very much in you. How women are unworthy. And look at my face as I say that. How women are unworthy of respect or dignity. Huh? How they're just here to do our dishes and wash the clothes, huh? And just cook our food. And that's what women are here for and nothing else. They're not good for anything else. See how that makes you feel as I even say these things out loud? Why is that? Why does it hurt you? Why? How come words can hurt you? It's because these words are not mere words to you. Your mind hears these words, and then what it does is it checks it against your ego, whether they are compatible. Whatever you find is incompatible with your egoistical view of the world, your perspectives, there you find conflict. And that's the pain that you feel in your heart when someone says such things to you. Religion and race are two very critical such factors, because it has been ingrained into our minds that we are our religion. We are our race, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's part of our whatity, our identity. It's part of our identity. Things that are part of your identity are things that are very hurtful if they're insulted. This is the problem. This is where you need to find solutions. Especially if you are someone, you know, I invite people in the audience to ask yourselves, if these are things that hurt you, then you are in great danger. You're in great danger because you never know when. You never know when someone might come up to you and ignite that flame within your heart. What if it's 2 seconds before your last breath? Then you die with anger, rage. Who's responsible for that? Indeed. Then what happens after that? Only God knows. Think about this. So what do people fight for? Why do people need control? People fight for control so that they can control the things that other people do, the things that other people say, the way that other people react to situations. Because it helps them be in their own comfort zones. That's what a control, your controller does. It helps, it tries to ensure your comfort zone. And to retain your comfort zone. See, now if it's getting too warm, we can turn up the aircon. If it's getting too cold, we can turn it down. All with the help of a remote controller. So when you go reaching for the remote controller next time you do it, perhaps spare a thought for what I have shared with you today. It's fine to go and grab it and get done what you want with it, but ask yourself, am I still someone who's looking for a remote control in all areas of my life? If you are the head of a company or, you know, in your community, when you have dissenting voices, what do you tend to do? You try and negotiate with them, right? You say, hey, excuse me, right? Let's have a conversation. We need to have a heart-to-heart here. Things are not going right because this is not what I want you to do. This is not the things I want you to say. It's not working out. But if they keep on doing and saying what they want to do, they want to say, then there comes a point where you'll have to take them out. Because you don't feel comfortable anymore When you don't feel comfortable, you do something about it, don't you? Because you want to remain in your comfort zone. When you're not feeling comfortable, things have to change. What has to change? The external world has to change. It's the very simple answer. It's the easiest answer. You know, it just rolls off your tongue, doesn't it? When you're not comfortable, what has to change? Others have to change. See? It just rolls off your tongue. Others have to change. Don't you have children who annoy you at home? Parents, don't your kids annoy you? Sometimes at least. And when you're annoyed, what are some of the things you do? Do you go to the shrine room at home and sit down and you do Arimaitri? Or in front of the Buddha statue at home, you sit down and say, you say, Putta, you know, Thati is really annoyed right now and Thati has failed, right? So because I should not be annoyed like this. Nothing of you doing. Thati is annoyed. Thati is a failure. If Swami Nahase got to know about me right now, he would be very disappointed in me. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go to the shrine room, sit down, and I'm going to do some meditation. In the meantime, you just behave as you wish. Is that what you're going to say? When you're annoyed, what do? You pick up the remote control. You pick up the remote control. Then you press the button on them. You say, you shall not speak to your father like that. Who do you think you are? And who do you think you are talking to? It's all in the remote. You know, it's one thing to stop your children from doing something they're not supposed to do, but it's another to be annoyed about it. One does not necessitate the other. These are not two peas in a pod. They don't have to come hand in hand. Your irritation is your problem. Your frustration is your problem. Your annoyance is your problem. These are all emotions that you cook up in your own mind. Your little one is not responsible for that. And if you knew that I was going to talk about this, I know you would not be bringing your children in today, won't you? Because they're going to use this as ammunition when you get back home. So next time you're annoyed at home, Dua, Putta, Tat is annoyed at home, Amma is annoyed at home, you look at them and go, eh, eh. I suggest you not, because you're not in a safe environment. This is Sri Lanka. I wish to remind you. Yesterday someone told me a nice story. They said there was a father and his son, young son, right? But he was not very obedient, so he used to misbehave quite a bit. And they were in some other country, so you might have heard this story. And so the father used to shout at him and at one point even beat the child. So what this child did was then, he rang up the authorities, this child protection agencies and whatnot, and then the police came down and they investigated the father. They took the father away and kept him remanded for a day or two, and then sent back and said, stern warning, you shall not do like that to your son again. So the father, of course, you know, he was very apologetic to his child and said, you know, don't worry, I will not do that again. Right, some months passed, and apparently they came back to Sri Lanka. And as soon as they got off the aircraft, at the airport, the father gave the child a good slap. And then he said, now you go to the police. So if we're at home, I suggest you don't do that, because Swami Nuase said so, because it's not a safe environment. Because the father's the head at home, right? Or the mother. But going back to the point though, the point is still valid. It is your responsibility as parents to stop your children from misbehaving. That is correct. You cannot wash your hands and shrug your shoulders. That responsibility lay with you. But that doesn't warrant you getting angry, irritated, agitated, annoyed. None of those things they are responsible for. So never ask this question, why do you annoy me like this? Get that out of your system. Those are all invalid questions. Why do you annoy me like this? No one annoys you. You can ask this question, why do you always do that? That's okay. That's a valid question. Why do you always say that? Why don't you answer when I ask you? Why don't you tell me the truth? Why do you lie? These are valid questions. But what's not a valid question? Why do you annoy me like this? Why do you make me angry like this? Those are not valid questions. If they are the cause of your anger, then I'll tell you, if you really believe that your children are the cause of your anger, hand them over to me. I will fix them, right? So that you don't get angry. Give them to me. I'll take them away for a few years. I will fix them up so that you don't get angry. I mean, it has to work both ways, right? If you're suggesting that your children are the cause of your anger, then give them to me so that I can fix them. So that they don't make you angry anymore. But if you understand and accept that you are the cause of your own anger, then you come with me. Either way, I get one of you. I'm like the Pied Piper. Free yourself from the need to be in control. But, you know, it's not something you can determine yourself out of. You know, you can't just make a resolution, by the end of this year, I will be free of the need to control. And then just get on with the rest of the year as you normally do. By the end of the year, nothing will have happened, I promise you. That's not how it works. There's no point in telling you not to get angry, because it's not something you do voluntarily. Don't be angry, okay? So even if you tell your children not to get angry, you know, sometimes say the siblings, they fight with each other, annoyed at each other, at each other's necks all the time. You say, don't get angry. Don't say that stupid talk thing. It doesn't make any sense. There's no point in saying don't get angry, because angry is not something we do voluntarily. It happens because of ego. Help the child kill their ego. And then anger won't ripen. Anger is a byproduct of ego. Desire is a byproduct of ego. Lust is a byproduct of ego. If you catch your kid watching pornography at home, there's little you can do by trying to block them out with the firewalls, checking their history, right, giving them screen time and locking them out and just, you know, standing by the side, watching them every time, whatever they do. There's very little you can do by doing these things, ladies and gentlemen. As one of my teachers once said, it's like having a piece of caca on your hand, which is it's a turd, right? Having one of feces in your hand and trying to chase the flies away. What's the point in doing that? A piece of poop on your hand and you chase the flies away. When are you going to win? Every time you chase one, two are coming in this direction. Two are inward, coming inward. Then you chase the two away, another four coming from this side. These are not practical solutions. They're not rational either. Makes no sense. You know, we are intelligent human beings, right? Thanks to our parents, thanks to our teachers, thanks to good friends and good association, right? We have equipped ourselves and cultivated wisdom, knowledge, right? Ability to analyze things and make sensible decisions. So it's about time that we start making sensible decisions about the things that happen in our lives. All of these things are side effects of the true problem, that is ego. That's why we spend time talking about the ego. Ego is a result of the ignorance of ego. I'll repeat that. Ego is a result of the ignorance of ego. So if you're ignorant of ego, then what will you have there? Ego. That's how it is. Any mind that is ignorant of ego, see? Let's all give them the evil lie. It's all right. It's all right. Don't worry about it. Don't worry at all. So that they... These are all these, you know, moments that we have to seize. It's an opportunity. Do we all need a remote control to switch off all the mobile phones and put them on mute? No, we don't need the remote control. Have self-control, not remote control. Remote control is so far overrated. Self-control, therefore, is lost. No one has a need for self-control, you just have remote control. You know, one doesn't replace the other. If you have a good teacher, if you have been taught how to react in the right way in these situations, then whenever something happens that you don't expect to happen, all you need to do in that situation is compassion. Wish them well. And I talked about this at some length on one day, but I'll remind you again. Because, you know, take this kind of audience where we have all agreed, right? We are going to put our phones on silent. We are going to move those bottles out of the way. We're not going to make a lot of noise in here. And then a phone goes off. You know, it's quite possible that sometimes you turn a device off, but you think it's switched off. You really know. You really think it's switched off. Right? But it's not. It's happened to me, of all people. Happened to me. Happens to the best of us. This happened to me. I thought it was switched off. But the phone had other plans. And some devices, you switch them off, but if you set the alarm on it, it will switch itself on. It's so determined to wake you up. It'll make sure that even if you switch it off, it'll turn itself on. So it might be that, you know, maybe there's a device like that somewhere here. So that could happen. You know, we have no problem with that. Do you understand that? We have no problem with you thinking that your phone's off, but it goes off anyway. All we ask is that if you know that you have a phone on you, which you must do, then try and do what you can to switch it off. If you don't know how to switch it off, which is possible, ask someone to do it for you. But in the event that it does happen, what do? We seize the opportunity. If you have a positive mindset, then every obstacle is seen as an opportunity. If you have a negative mindset, every opportunity is seen as an obstacle. See, now whenever I have to clear my throat, you know I'm still recovering and there's little bits of it left still. Whenever I do that, when I have to clear my throat, right? You don't have to sit there in the room thinking, "Oh, you power." It's when you do that, I feel, you vedak ne appa. That's what I would feel if that's what you thought. Instead, right? Metta. A moment of metta. If you don't believe my words, I'll tell you the Buddha's words. On one occasion, he gives a Dakkhina Vibhanga Sutta. Beautiful sutta, beautiful discourse, just like all of his discourses, but this one in particular really caught my attention. He analyzes giving. Vibhanga is to analyze, to break down, to analyze. Dakhi. Dakhina is dana, charity, giving, generosity. That's why we have Dakhina here. So in this discourse, he talks about the merit of giving and how the recipient of that giving multiplies the merit that you earn as a result of giving to them. So he starts with lowly creatures like animals. And then he says, I'll give you one example. It is far more beneficial, let's say 100 times more beneficial, right, to give to an individual who is a putakjana. A putakjana is someone who has no understanding of the Dhamma. So somehow it is far more beneficial to give a putakjana than to feed 100 animals. He talks about the merit of giving and how the power of merit is multiplied by the virtue of the receiving party. So he goes on with this discourse, and then he says how it is far more virtuous to give your dana to someone who's on the path to becoming a sotapanna than it is to give to 100 individuals who are mere prutakjanas. And then he goes on to say how it is far more beneficial to give your dana to a sotapanna than it is to give to 100 who are still on the path to becoming a sotapanna. So you get the gist. Like this, he continues his discourse, and towards the end he says, it is far more beneficial than to give to many anagamis or even people who are on the path to becoming a rahatanvahanse than to give to an anagami. And finally he says, it is far more beneficial to give to an arahant than it is to give to those who are on the path to becoming an arahant. And then to the Buddha, Paccheka Buddha, Buddha. But the last thing he says is this: far more beneficial than all of those givings, you know, including the Buddha, right? Who is Aggadakkhineya, who is supreme among those who are worthy of your offerings. Right? I repeat that. The Buddha is called Aggadakkhineya, who is supreme among those who are worthy of your offering. It's far more beneficial to take a moment to contemplate metta than it is to give to a Buddha. So when a phone goes off, what do you do? See? That's why I say, Supatthaya. May you be well. That's the wish. May you be well. Whoever it is, it doesn't matter where it went off. Because here's something we know. Whoever's phone went off, in their hearts, they're worried now. They feel a sense of guilt. It's a very natural response. They feel a sense of guilt because we've just agreed that we're going to put it all on mute or on silent, but my phone's gone off. Now I have interrupted, I have disrupted the sermon. Right? Have I done something bad? Is it going to be bad on me? What will others think of me? So if anyone's in any doubt what others are going to think of you, let's clear that doubt. Right? Let's clear that doubt. How can we clear that doubt? Let's all come to an agreement what we are going to think of them. What? May you be well. Now you don't have to be in any doubt what others are going to be thinking of you if your phone goes off. Because we have all come to an agreement. Anyone disagree with that? Anyone think, no, we shouldn't be wishing them well? How dare they? What we should do is take the phone and throw it out the window. I mean, how many times must we tell them? You tend to do this, like, how many times have I told you? All this, how many times, all this is a product of ego, ladies and gentlemen. I will explain to you one at a time. I will explain all of these things to you, how you feel that you have said the same thing to the same person so many times. When actually, no such thing has happened. You cannot get into the same river twice. If you can't get in and step into the same river twice, how can you give the same bit of advice to the same person twice? Any advice you give, this is the very first time you've given it and the very first time they've heard it. Why do you expect them to now comply with your previous advice? Because you think this is the same person I gave that advice to earlier. That's your fault. So thinking is wrong thinking. That's a result of your ego, not this. May I ask you a question? If the Buddha Sasana is not liberating, what is? If the Buddha's teaching is not liberating, may I ask you, what is? These teachings can free you even from those adversities that you face, those minor, micro, almost negligent, insignificant, but still bothers you. How many times have I told you not to do this? Don't you have these conversations at home? When your husband takes off his socks, once he comes back from work, where does he leave them? Wherever he's not supposed to leave them, right? That's where he leaves them. Then what is your response? How many times? And when he leaves the toilet seat up, or you leave the toilet seat down, whichever way, how many times? Marriages have turned to divorces because of a toilet seat. You know this, I've told you this before. It's common knowledge. This how many times have I told you this is all nonsense. It's nonsense because your ego is nonsense. You know, in this game, we start, we continue, and we end by pointing the finger inwards. That is why this teaching is so empowering. The recognition that the power to free myself lay within me. That is what I mean by empowering. And no one else can snatch it from me. You can't take away my liberating force. It's with me. I was born with it. I live with it and I die with it. It can never be stolen from me. So that was an extra bonus lesson about the Dakkhina Vibhanga. Therefore, we today sometimes regret not having the Buddha amongst us to give an offering to. If we had the Buddha amongst us, oh, how nice it would have been. We could have all got together as the Dharmishtha Rajagirians. We could have gone up to the Buddha and given him a great alms offering, right? And I'm sure you would have done that. So perhaps you regret, are you? If Buddha were here, we could have done that. But the Buddha himself says there's an offering far greater than that. Don't we often miss those opportunities? Whenever you hear or get come to know of some misfortune, whenever you get to hear or come to know of some misfortune, in your mind, wish them well. May all beings be well. So, these days there are things going on. Every day there's going to be things going on. So if you are still subscribed to the news, you still get to know, or maybe it's part of your job, you have to be up to date with what's going on in the world. When you hear this many people have died, this has happened, that bomb's gone off, this place has been targeted, right? Typically what people tend to feel is fear, anger, remorse, regret, sometimes even hate. Why do these people do these things? That doesn't do you any good. Trust me, that doesn't do you any good at all. That's why one of the worst things you can do these days is to get together with your friends, sit around the dining table or the coffee table or whatever table and just, bicker about other countries and why, how they should be doing this and they should be doing that and why aren't they doing this and why aren't they doing that? Because there's a war out there, yes, but what are you doing at home? In your heart, there's another war. That's not how wars are ended. This is what's going on. Typically in most households, this is what would be happening. I can understand, you know, if it's authorities, officials, they have to get together, they have to discuss this, but that's their job. They have to do it. Right? But it's not your job. Your job is to spread peace, compassion, loving kindness, start at home. So if there's some misfortune going on out there, don't bring that into your home. Let them fight it out. If that's the way they have chosen to resolve their disagreements, then let them fight it out. Don't bring that into your home. Talk about something good. Because anger, hatred, it wounds the earth. Compassion and loving kindness, they heal the earth. So while they're warring, why don't you start healing? Not by talking about what they're doing. That doesn't help. But you think they want your advice? So you have these lengthy discussions, right? Sometimes over dinner, you talk about it for hours. Let's be honest. Don't all nod at once. You know, you believe you me, at the monastery, we don't talk about any of this stuff. We don't talk about any of this stuff. Because we are busy. We are very busy talking about all the goodness that's going on in the world. Talking about all the goodness that's happening within the monastery. About the goodness that our devotees are getting up to. When you come here and I see you do something good, when you do something good for each other, right? When I get to hear about this, oh, believe you me, the first thing I do when I get back to the monastery is talk about it with the people I see. And I take it up to Guru Hanu as well. And I get a chance and say, Guru Hanu, do you know this Mahatma, this Mahatmya, she's done this, he's done that. This is how they help each other, they look after each other. That's what I do. I haven't spoken with Guru Hanu about the war that's going on there. So if I haven't spoken about it with him, then no one else at the monastery would have. Because what good are we going to do by talking about it? If they wanted our advice, they would consult us. Yeah? And then I give my opinion. But what do I know about wars? I don't know how to fight. I don't know how to be angry at people. I know how to love people. I know how to care. I know how to be kind. I know how to help people find peace within. So this is the thing I talk about. Therefore, within our monastery, it's always peaceful. And we feel that that is our job, to spread goodness into this world. If we can be a source of goodness, then let's spread it from where we are. Remember, your heart is the instrument that God has given you to heal the world. Your heart is the instrument that God has given you to heal the world. If you forget that, then someone will come and tell you that your heart is what the devil has given you to hate the world. Careful. Be careful. So I urge you, if you are truly Dharmishta Rajagiriyans, and if it's not just a fancy word that you have put in front of Rajagiriyans, it's not just to impress me that you have put this Dharmishta thing in front of your name. If you are truly Dharmishta, then be Dharmishta in action. Be Dharmishta in your intentions. Be Dharmishta in your conduct. Make that your virtue. You have to be Dharmishta within. So I urge you, stop talking about this. Stop talking about it. If you have to talk about it at the workplace, okay, right? It's fine. because it's your part of your job. But if at work, not for work, but at work, two different things, right? For work is another. But at work, by the water decanter, by the coffee machine, when you get around the, you know, your working area and people come up to you, you are very nice. Don't you start those maravedinis. And if they start talking about that stuff, right, bring it to a polite but very, make it short. Don't create space in your heart to talk about anger, hatred and what bad people do. So what, when badness takes over people, what badness does, don't spend time talking about all that stuff. That's why I'm not a big fan of newspapers. You pay your hard-earned cash to buy a piece of junk. You take a newspaper home if you want tonight, right? And make a list of, mark each news article you find, where there is something that helps you to rejoice in goodness of mankind, humanity, versus those things that ignite in you anger, lust, greed, hatred, remorse, resentment, frustration, anger, right? And make a list of those things. You do the math. Then work out the ratio. You don't want to be a bad person, do you? But the piece of junk you just bought is going to make you worse than you are. It will. That's what you paid for. You paid for that junk. This one you get for free. This is free. Junk you buy. Seriously. So you say, but Swaminas, you know, petrol prices are going up. We have to know about that. Gas prices are shooting up the roof. We have to know about that. Yeah, are you going to control it somehow? Whatever the gas price is, if you need gas, what do you have to do? You buy the damn thing, right? Whatever the petrol price is, if you have to put petrol into your cars, what do you have to do? You do. What can you do about it? Here's what you can actually do about it. Metta. Spread compassion. Spread kindness. In your heart, you don't need to go and talk to people for that. If you can, you do. But if you can't, spread it in your heart. Spread loving kindness. Because your heart is a source of compassion. For every time you think good, something good happens in this world. Trust me when I say this. For every thought you have that's a good thought, something good happens in this world. There's a ripple effect somewhere. Like when a butterfly flaps its wings here, there's a tornado in some other part of the world, right? When you do something good, when you think something good happens in somewhere, some part of this world. So I urge you, ladies and gentlemen, don't bring the war into your homes. Don't make your homes a war zone. People enjoy scaremongering. They do that. They want to make money out of your ego. They exploit your ego. Because when you put fear into people's hearts, right, it burns them from within. Therefore, you want to find out what happened last night. The moment you wake up, you take your mobile phone out and you check, oh my God, what's happened? When is that missile going to come? This way. Right? Or how are those international relations and how is that going to affect us? Are they going to take away our scholarships? Are they going to take away our funding? Are they going to take away our, I don't know, whatever? Are we not going to have oil for the next 10 years? You know, we have elected a group of people who are willing to carry that burden on our behalf. You know what you can do? Wish them well. They're busy running the country on your behalf. Why don't you make yourselves busy spreading compassion to them? So that with that compassion, with that loving kindness, with that goodwill,
They can do a better job. It's easier to fix this country if people only worked on themselves, improving themselves a little bit more, being a bit kinder, just a little bit more. Cultivated a little bit more compassion. Spoke just one more soft word to their neighbor instead of just having a go at them. But those who wish to make money out of you, they will publish all these scaremongering articles in the newspapers, on the media, and social media. You know, there are people who hire young people who've got nothing better to do with their lives, jobless people, right? They hire them to make up news articles, fake, and they put it on social media. And because we are all only six hops away from everyone else in this world, right? That article that goes on social media is on your Facebook wall or in your Instagram or something within a matter of seconds. And it goes viral, these things. Why do these things go viral? Do these sermons go viral? No, they don't. You know why these sermons don't go viral? It's because they don't incite fear. They don't incite lust. They extinguish them. Therefore, this does not create vexation in the heart. These words, they don't wound, they heal. When do you go to the doctor? Imagine this. It's late at night. And the nearest clinic opens at 7 o'clock in the morning, the following morning, right? You are sick. You've got a griping stomach ache. You're feeling very ill. Now you can't wait until 7 in the morning, right? When the clinic opens so that you can rush yourself in there. See, you need to relieve yourself when you're vexed, when you're in pain. That's whenever. Whenever you're in pain, you are looking for the next opportunity to relieve yourself, to vent your pain. Be that anger. When you're angry, what do you typically tend to do? Keep shut and just remain calm, cool, collected, and just, you know, sit down. What happens when you're angry? You want to vent it out. Yeah? So either you find someone to say it with, maybe you ring someone and just ring your best friend and say, you know what happened to me? I'm just having a really tough day, really terrible day. This happened, that happened, this, and the other friend goes, what? They, really? Really? Oh, really? They shouldn't have done something like that to you. And they also take your side, further exacerbating the problem. Your friend never tells you that it was your fault that it happened. They just side with you because they just, that's what you wanted. You wanted a ear to listen to your agony. Right? That's what they do. But when you're happy, when you're truly happy, you're content. Then you don't need to go anywhere. You just relax. You're happy. You're settled when you're happy. You're tranquil when you're happy. You're relaxed. You're at peace when you're happy. But when you're not, now you have to do something about it. Like the pressure cooker. Once the pressure builds inside, now you have to scream out to the whole world, even if it's with a whistle. I'm under pressure. You have to say that to the whole world. That's why scaremongering is something people do to make money out of those who have egos. Like the doctor whose clinic you can't wait until 7 in the following morning to get to because you have a stomachache. In the same way, when they put fear into your minds through newspapers, social media, whatnot, now you can't wait until the next news update. Think about it. Really think about it. See how you are entrapped in this cycle. It becomes a vicious cycle. This is for your merits. You are hearing these words from me, ladies and gentlemen, because I don't need this stuff. Because I don't subscribe to the news. I don't watch it. I don't care about what's going on the other side of the world. All I care about is He said, if there's someone I can heal, I heal them, if they're ready to take it. But I want to show you how people are exploiting your egos and then somehow try and help you to come out of that ego. But until you're convinced that ego is your problem, ego is the shared enemy, the common enemy here, until you're convinced of that, I'm trying to give you example after example as to how people are exploiting that. You are vulnerable for as long as you suffer from an ego. That's what they do. It's not because they're bad, they do it because they themselves have an ego. So they themselves have vexations. But you're just merely lab rats then. They exploit you. So now, because thanks to technology, all this information is readily available, isn't it? You say it's a blessing. Huh, sure. How many websites are you subscribed to? You know, now they have not just those websites. Those days, even when I was a layman, they had these RSS feeds. Right? Very quickly, you get your updates. And there are apps. They aggregate all these news sources into one app. Right? So you don't have to just check with one news provider. You can check another, and the other, and the other, and the other. I used to know people who used to watch the news on every single channel. On one night. Just to get a different perspective. Of the same rubbish. If you want to go see this Blumenthal, what do you call it? That rubbish mountain, right? Well, if imagine you want to have a look at it, and we arrange a tour. We take you there and we show you one facet. You want to do the 360 degrees as well, to take every perspective of it. When your dog comes and does the dirty in your living room, do you go close to it and study it? And study it like from 360 degrees? Huh? You take the butter knife and you cut it. Take the fork and you just poke it to see whether it's sticky on the inside, rough on the outside, but maybe smooth on the inside. You don't do that, right? Because it's kakka. What do? If possible, you would close one eye, just look it with the other eye, because you don't want to look at that stuff, right? And as quickly as possible, get it out. Because it's stinking your home. That's what it's doing. You know what's worse? You know what's worse than that? What's going on right now? I don't care about the war that's going on up there right now, because there's nothing I can do about it. But if you are foolish enough to bring that war into your homes, shame on you. Shame on you. So I speak to you with love. Don't do that. Don't make your home a war zone. Should be a zone for peace, compassion, loving kindness, goodness. Don't give people who spread hatred space in your heart. Don't give them space to do what they want to do. You can take them into your heart, only to do what you want to do with them. But how they make their money is, they get you worried about what's happening right now. Because you have an ego, now you're scared about what's going to happen to you in the next moment, maybe in a couple of hours' time, in a day's time. Therefore, they can now be assured that you will buy tomorrow's paper as well. But you don't have to buy papers now. It's all available for free on the internet. Indeed. If anything is free, then you are the commodity. If anything is free, then you are the commodity. Don't be that. You know, just don't just go with the flow, ladies and gentlemen. You have a brain, you have a mind, you have a common sense, right? With due respect to your teachers, to your adults, your parents, who brought you up the right way and taught you to choose right from wrong and make intelligent and wise choices, right? Don't just go with the flow. Make the right choices. At every moment in your life, make the right choices. I'm a bunch of right choices, can't you see? Make the right choice. I always make the right choice. As best I can, I make the right choice. Sometimes I make mistakes. Yes, of course, I'm only human. But as soon as I realize it's a mistake, I quickly fix it. And make the right choice again. The day I learned that newspapers were simply spoiling me, rotting me from the inside, I stopped reading them. That was many years before I became an ordained, before I ordained myself, before I got ordained, many years before that. I realized what impact it was having on me. So I stopped reading that rubbish and I started reading a good book on personal development, because I didn't have the Dhamma back then. I read it up on personal development, how I can develop my internal skills, find my strengths, identify my weaknesses, how I can make up a plan and target those, how I can become a better leader, how I can become a better orator. Those are the books that I spent my time with soon after I realized that newspapers were just junk. I have nothing against any particular media company, or I'm talking about generally. Generally, if you don't believe me, like I said, take a newspaper home, you do the math and work it out for yourself, whether it does more harm or whether it does more good to you than harm. So I felt the need to talk to you about this today, because it's getting worse, right? And apparently it's one thing's leading to the next, and there's no sign of any peace in the horizon. I don't know, I might be wrong, right? There's no sign of it apparently. I only know this if someone comes and volunteers information to me. I never ask people, hey, what's going on there, what's going on? People just sometimes come and tell me about it. Because I have a bigger battle closer to home. I still feel myself. That's a problem. That's a big problem. But I want you to understand this, if nothing else. For as long as you have this ego within yourself, people will exploit you. By spreading fear, lust, anger, all these things. Like I said, if you believe that you are a woman, right, there will be people who will instigate anger, hatred in you, animosity in you. They could get you to start hating society as a whole. If you identify yourself with a race, those years ago, young boys and girls were recruited. They were enlisted and then they were brainwashed. They had no reason, no rhyme or reason, no reason to pick up a weapon. You know, two young men in their teens who used to play with each other on the play fields. They used to farm together on the paddy fields. They used to go to school together. And then one fine day, they got picked up, taken to different centers, brainwashed. Nationalism, racialism, religion, our heritage, our history, all these thoughts put into their minds. And now they're no longer human beings, but they're weapons walking on two legs. And now you put the two of them back together, they will fight each other till the end. These things used to happen back in the day used to happen. How sometimes some, I'm not going to name anyone, it's not right to do so. Some people, what they used to do, people from one side, they used to go and enlist. Actually, it wasn't called enlisting, it was just more, shall we say, what's a polite way to put it? So they used to take these meetings, and they used to invite all young people of their own race, their own race. But these were not the innocent people. Of their own race, they used to take these meetings and then bring them to a certain place, right? And then said, so this is your country, this is your part, this is that, this is that, this is your legacy, this is your history, this is your race, this is your religion, this is all that. Now, are you willing to give up your life for that? And then they would say, yes, yes, we are ready to give up our lives for that. For your country, for your mother, for your nation, are you willing to give up your life? So the moment they say yes, you know what they do next? They torture them. They themselves torture them. Cut them up, wound them up. Slice them, dice them. Cut their digits, hands, fingers, limbs, amputate them. And then go and leave them in a public place. The following night, morning, people come up and they see young men dead, with their bodies in a very, very bad state. But this happened over a period of several days to weeks. And before this last event, the boys used to go home and talk to their parents about how the other party are so terrible and how they're here to destroy our country and take away our race and take away our religion and destroy us and wipe us off the surface of the earth. So now they had already, people in the village already were of the opinion that this was done by the other side. Now that was the perfect plot to instigate anger in all of the villages. So now it was not just two individuals fighting against each other. Now there was a whole community who had harbored hate against the others. These were fantastic plots that were plotted in meeting rooms. Some people wanted to make money out of it. Some people wanted power out of it, authority. And why were those young boys vulnerable to this? Because of ego. That's what happened. I'm sure it must have happened both ways. They'll kill their own people to make it look like it was the enemy who'd done it. See? Very civilized, isn't it? You might say that's barbaric. So what do? That's what we are doing now. For as long as people live with an ego, you can be formed up. You can be motivated. You can be manipulated in whichever way people want. Therefore, true freedom from war, true freedom from anger, true freedom from lust, desire, all these things come when you find freedom from your ego. So that's what we're going to talk about now. If you have understood why it's important that we do it, then let's talk about how we do it. But you must promise me that you shall not bring the war home. Don't do that to you. Don't do that to your families. Don't do that to your children. Your children are very young. They're very impressionable. Whatever you say, they will take as gospel truth. Right? So if you have an opinion right now about who's right and who's wrong, they will grow up with that. If you haven't done your homework to find out exactly what happened, why it's this, why it's that, and you're only just relaying information that was passed down to you, then you do that to your children, and now your children grow up with your own, you know, whatever you know is what your children know. Do you think what everything you know is right? So do you filter when you tell your children something? Do you only tell them what you have verified? Only what is perfectly right and accurate and precise is what you give your children? Or do you just say whatever comes to mind? You speak freely with them. I know, that's how it is in every household. I grew up thinking about the world the way that my apache taught. And how my amma thought. And how my teachers thought. They didn't filter what they said. They just said. And here's me like a little sponge, absorbing everything that comes at me. Your children does the same. So you see, if in your household now you have young children who think that the attitude that we must have towards war is one of resentment and all that, and not compassion. And if they have been brought up, and if they're in a household where you're talking about you're siding with one part or the other, one side or the other, you know, you're thinking this country's, they're innocent, that country, they're bad. The next day they're going to meet someone from that country. And then, you know, you people, that's what they're going to say. Trust me, that's what they're going to say. You people. That's going to create all sorts of problems. Therefore, the common culprit is whom? It's ego. No one's bad. Ego is what's bad. And let's talk about ego. What is ego? Now you know what it does. But what is it? Ego is not you. Ego is what you think you are. That's very simple to say, but it's a very profound idea to get your head around. Ego is not you. It's what you think you are. This is you. We have an object. We have a faculty. They come into contact. Out of that is born awareness. You can also call it consciousness. When an object comes in contact with the faculty, the result is awareness. Awareness that this has happened. Because awareness of what, right? That's a question, it's a good question. Awareness, but awareness of what? You can be aware about something. You need something to be aware about, right? Awareness of something. See if this is clear to you. Check, make sure you're clear with this before I take you further down this path. There's an object, there's a faculty. When the two come to contact, the result is awareness. You can also call it consciousness because this is you're conscious. Like you say, when you say someone's unconscious, when you say someone's unconscious, what does that mean? They don't respond, isn't it? Where's the patient? still unconscious. How does the doctor know that the patient's unconscious? They go up to them and go over their face, tap them, knock them, no response. Yeah? That's when you say they are unconscious, meaning they're not conscious about things that are going on around them. So then what is consciousness? To be conscious, so consciousness is the instrument of conscience. Well, not good conscience, bad conscience. It's being conscious about object coming to contact with faculty. So what faculties are we talking about here? There's a medical faculty, law faculty. What faculties? This is the indriya, right? In the Pali we call them indriya. What are the faculties? Eyes? Yes. Our nose, tongue, and body. So these are the five main faculties, but there's also the mind faculty. This is how you have memory, imagination, thoughts about things. But we know that basically we have the five faculties, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and the body. You can put the mind up here if you want, it's fine, no problem. So these five or six faculties, they come into contact with objects. So these objects must be complementary, mustn't they? So if it says a vibration, which of these faculties can sense vibrations? Yes. Indeed, ears can sense vibrations. What else? Oh, sorry, that was the eye. Yes. Should I have erased the arrow? Should I have erased that arrow? Why not? What do the eyes detect? Vibrations, yes. Same. Only we call them electromagnetic vibrations. These are mechanical vibrations. Those are electromagnetic vibrations. You can call it radiation if you want, but these are vibrations. Then what are the other objects? Nose, do they detect vibrations? Vibrations? No, they don't detect vibrations. They detect shapes. Shapes. Your automatic answer will be smells. See? Your mind will say, my nose detects smells. No, the nose doesn't detect smells. Because smells are not at the nose. They don't happen at the nose. Consciousness is smell. So smell doesn't happen up here. There is no object called smell. And there's no object called color. There's no object called softness, heat, cold, pain. These are not objects. Roughness, is that an object? No, these are not objects. These are all shapes. So, you have vibrations up here, and then nose, tongue, and body. What do they detect? Shapes. Yes. So, think of a pappadam. You take a pappadam. When you hold it to your nose, you can smell a freshly cooked pappadam. It has this oily smell, right, and flour. Cooked in oil, kind of smell. So what's actually going on there? This is your nose. These are your nostrils. Then, this is the pappadam. You take a whiff. What happens? These are particles. This is air. But particles of the pappadam, maybe oil particles, right, or other very tiny particles that can float in the air, right, they travel from the pappadam to your nose. And then there are receptors in your nose which detect smell. Yes? Really? They detect smell? No. What do they detect? Shapes. Yes, they detect shapes. So there's a shape. Sorry, that's not what your nose looks like. But if that is your nose, okay, let's say like this, there's a receptor. So this is a receptor. Imagine that. And this is a nerve. Okay? So this is a shape receptor. So if there are particles from the pappagam that take this shape and they carry, the wind carries it, the air carries it, and it comes and slots into the receptor on your nose. Then what happens? It triggers an electrical pulse. So where's the smell? Can we talk about smell so far? No smell at all. There's no smell here. So this electrical signal goes up to your brain, and then that serves as the object. This same particle, if we stuck it on the end of your tongue. So in the tongue, if you had a similar receptor, similar shape, the same particle, you could stick it here, and then you sense what? Now it's taste. See? If the same particle can trigger two stimuli, one is the smell, another is the taste, then is this smell or taste? This one. If the same particle can trigger both smell and taste, depending on which receptor it triggers, then is this a smell or is it a taste? It's neither. It's neither. It's neither smell nor taste. Is it one of them or both of them? Is it either one of them or both of them? Do you understand the question? So this has to be either a smell, a taste, or both smell and taste, right? Yes? Hi, oh yes? Yes? No. Is it this, or this? No. It's not smell, it's not taste, and it's neither. It's not smell and taste either. It's none of these things. What is it? It's just a shape. A shape. What shape? What smell is a shape? What does a triangle smell like? What does a triangle taste like? How about circles then? What do circles taste like? You understand it's an absurd question, right? Then why do you hold something to your nose, a piece of chocolate or a piece of cake or a flower to your nose and say, it smells lovely? Why do you say that? If this is an absurd question, isn't that an absurd observation that you make when you say this rose smells so sweet? Because smell is not in the rose. Then taste is not in the chocolate. It's not in the cake. Smell is not in the pappadam. All it has are shapes. Yeah? So where do you get the karas karas when you put it in your mouth and crunch on it? Is that in the pappadam? If you hold it to your ear, you're going to hear that? No. So what's happening then? How do you get that noise? When you dig your teeth into the pappadam, that mechanical movement causes these particles to do what? Vibrate. So when these particles vibrate, your oral cavity is full of air. So what happens? The air particles vibrate or resonate with these particles. So if they start vibrating at, this is a very arbitrary number, let's say at 100 hertz, right? Then the air particles surrounding the pappadam in your mouth, they also vibrate. And usually you hear the sound from within you, right? It doesn't come through your ears this way. It goes up all these canals up to your nose, maybe your ears, sorry. So then your internals vibrate. So your bones, your cheekbones, all the stuff that your face is made of, they vibrate until your eardrums pick up that vibration. And then they vibrate. So is that the sound of a pappadam? So what is the sound of a pappadam then? Karas, karas. What is the sound of glass breaking? What does breaking glass sound like? Does it have a sound? What does a bell sound like? A bell. It's called a chime, isn't it? What does it sound like? Ding dong. Wasn't that the bell? And when your phone goes off, what does that sound like? None of these sound anything. They have no sound. Sound is a purely mental perception. Right. So these are objects then, ladies and gentlemen, because your nervous system is able to pick up these interactions between the external world and your senses, your physical senses, right? When those things collide, the sense is triggered. That's why they call senses. They sense. They sense stuff. That's how somebody, are you out of your senses? When do people say that? All of the time, Swami, answer. When do people say, are you out of your senses? It's when you can't pick up quite what's going on, right? When you don't read a situation properly. Huh? Isn't that when someone says, are you out of your mind? Are you out of your senses? Right? So, what do your senses do? They sense. What do they sense? Going-ons. They sense going-ons. Things are going on. Around the world, everywhere, things are going on. So they sense these going-ons. So what do? They sense and then they bring them as objects. When these objects... So, this is what happens. So the objects and the faculty, they contact. This is what it is. They contact. Now, you need to become aware. Aware of what? The going on. That's why it's called awareness. Also why it's called consciousness. Now you're conscious. Okay? Clear so far? So how do we understand this consciousness? What does it look like in... What are our favorite letters? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana. So we've come this far. Okay? So now we have the object that has come into contact with the faculty. Out of that comes this rupa. This is called rupa. Rupa is form. In other words, it is the mental impression of this happening. You see the happening here? There's a happening. There's an event. An incident. Right? This is an event. Or an incident. This incident triggers a mental impression. Now this is, now we're in the mind realm. None of this is physical. None of this is physical. By this point, ladies and gentlemen, you could lose your nose and your eyes and your ears and your whatever other parts of your body, and the mind wouldn't care one bit. Because now it has taken this mental impression, now it can work with it. So here's the yield of this work. This is the yield. And this is also a vipaka. So it comes from your karmic strand. So these are the karmas that were committed prior to this moment. So they come as a vipaka, meaning a karma coming to fruition. So when this physical interaction happens, now there's a mental stimulus, a mental impression. Remember, everything mental, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, has to be a product of vipaka. Nothing you see here can be anything but what? But what? But vipaka. Everything you see here is vipaka. So vipaka is the effect. So when we talk about karma and vipaka, Karma is the intention, what you do. Vipaka is when it comes back. Okay? So these are all vipaka. Right, so now we are at this point. It's a rupa. Not very useful right now. You don't really know what's going on. So this is the awareness process. We are now lifting the bonnet and looking underneath to figure out how this awareness thing is going on. What's this consciousness? How does consciousness actually happen? What do we mean by consciousness? What are the internal workings of consciousness? This is the vipaka that was pulled out of this karmic strand as a result of these two things coming into contact with each other. Is this making sense? Sure? Okay. You know, this is a bit like... This is a bit like news. When you watch the news, something happens in the world and the news reporter at home on your TV reports it. So this only serves as input. The actual incident is not what you see on TV. Do you get the analogy? What you see on TV for news is not the actual incident. It's not the actual event. Let's say there's some sports. Say the two countries are playing cricket. Okay? And you're watching it on TV. When your favorite team scores a run, on TV, the score will go up by one. Is that the actual run that was scored on the field? What you see on TV, is that the actual run that you saw on the score that was scored on the field? See, if that were true, how many TVs are watching this right now or displaying this right now? Hundreds, if not thousands, right? So if that was this, then how many runs have been scored right now? It'll be the number of TVs that have it displaying at the moment, won't it? So you see, that is not this. It is an impression of it, not the same thing. Are we clear on that? Right? So this rupa is not the physical event. It's a mental impression of the physical event. Therefore, there can be an infinite number of these things. Because this is a result of a vipaka coming from your karmic strand. So do you see, in response to this, if there's life faculty, if there's life, let's call it life. If there's life in this system, okay, what do you mean by if there's life in this system? Meaning there's a karmic strand connected to this physical body. That's what I mean. When you say that someone's alive, what does that actually mean? Doctors will tell you the heart's beating. Others will tell you the brain's still working. Others will tell you the lungs are still pumped, are still inhaling, exhaling. But here's what it means to be truly alive. According to Buddha's teaching, it's when there's a karmic strand connected to some form of physical existence, some physical body. It's called a savijnanika body. There's a karmic strand connected to a physical body. So for each of these bodies in the room, hopefully there's still a karmic strand connected to it. And hopefully it'll be like that until I end up, finish and leave the school. Otherwise I will have to go and give a statement to the police. That's how we know you're alive. So let's assume there's a body in a coma. No response. You touch it, you poke it, you strike it, you do whatever, you prod it, no response. You connect whatever electrodes and stuff to it, you electrocute the thing, nothing happens. Right? Complete state of, I don't know, what's the word? Vegetation. Thank you. Complete state of vegetation. It's like a vegetable. No response to any of these things. Right? Can you deem it dead? According to our conversation now. Can it be deemed dead? So if you pull the plug now, right? Assume there's a plug. That is what keeps the system running. So it keeps the heart beating, circulates the blood throughout the body, right? It keeps this vegetable alive, essentially. Right? If you disconnect that from this life support mechanism, is it okay because it's already dead? No, for as long as there's a karmic strand connected to that body, because eyes, ears, nose, tongue and body are now non-functional, therefore these faculties are not coming to contact with objects and therefore the body doesn't become aware. Or there's no awareness. You can't say the body doesn't become aware. I correct that. Just because there's no awareness of these things, there's still a mind up here. Right? So the mind can still work on its own. You don't need the five senses for that. The mind can still work on its own. And when the mind works on its own, what happens is, that's what's called the mind faculty. Viparkas simply draw. Without the need for any of the physical objects to come into contact with the faculty. So the mind has the ability to draw on vipaka without the need for a physical object coming into contact with the faculty. Does that make sense to everyone? Give me a show of hands if that didn't make sense to you. Okay. Then I'll repeat that once again. The mind has an ability to draw on this account. So if you think in terms of banking terms, it's an account. Here's where you've made your deposits, right? And now you're drawing on that account. You can draw on that account. The mind can do it by itself without the need for satara dhatu, like the four elements, meaning vibrations, shapes. These are the two things that we have, right? These are vibrations. Eyes and ears are vibrations. Nose, tongue and body are shapes. So with neither vibrations or shapes coming into contact with your faculties, the mind by itself can draw on these vipakas. So that's why the mind can exist on its own without a body. Scriptures will tell you that there is always a body, but that body will be very subtle. You can have the subtlest of bodies. They don't have to be coarse bodies, physical, heavy bodies like yours and mine. The subtlest of bodies, sometimes, it's even difficult to give you an analogy. Like, let's say the wind, a bit of air, that could be a body. Just a bit of air. Just a bit of air. That could be a body. An atom, let's say, just to get your head around it, an atom could be a body. Just one atom, that could be a body. For as long as it's connected to a karmic strand, there's some connection there, vipakas will draw. But for the argument, for the sake of this argument, you can assume that minds can work on their own. They don't need a physical body, per se, to start drawing vipaka, because here, the object to the mind is Dhamma. Dhamma can be memories. Or there's also, it's possible that there are... No, let's not go there. It gets complicated. But do you understand that the mind can work on its own? Right, that's enough for now. Then we are going to get into what this process is. This is stuff we've talked before, right? But I'm going over it. So we're all on board. Rupa then is what? One of these karmic seeds coming to fruition. We call it coming to fruition. Come to fruition. So it's fruit, the fruit of a tree. That's when something's happened, it's ripened, right? So when this karmic energy ripens, it comes out as a vipaka. It's called a vipaka because a vipaka itself, a vipaka does not have regenerating ability. Vipaka does not have regenerative abilities. Only karma has that. Excuse me. Karma is what has regenerative ability. Excuse me. Vipaka does not have any regenerative ability. All vipaka can do is bring an experience. That's it. Vipaka brings out an experience. That's it. The experience itself cannot generate another experience. Consciousness is merely the processing of that experience. It is awareness of that experience. So when the object comes into contact with the faculty, one of these are multiple karmic actions which generated karmic seeds, one of these comes out as a vipaka. So now this is a rupa. So what happens now then? This rupa is now registered, by which I mean it is acknowledged. Think of it as an acknowledgement. So it's like someone knocking on the door, right? You go and open the door and you say, hello. And then it's typically usually after that, you go, oh, hey. But you're already prepared to say hello because you might be a stranger. I mean, they're always a stranger until you identify them, right? So it's always a stranger on the other side of the door until you take that image, you pass it into your memory, and then it comes back and says, yeah, I know this person. This is their name. Until then, what are they? A stranger. So if it's a stranger, the best you can do is acknowledge them. You know, it's like when you bump into an old friend, but you don't remember this person. What happens? So you bump into them and you're like, hey, machan. And you say, now you're embarrassed because they just called you machan. They've gone all the way, like it's the full full spectrum, right? They've gone machan, all the way machan, not even mister. Now you feel that you have to know this person. Yeah? Otherwise it's embarrassing. So what do you do? Yeah. You don't know what to say, what not to say, but you have to pretend like you know this person because otherwise it will be seen rude to not acknowledge them. See, you don't now you have acknowledged them at this point. But what have you not done? You've not recognized them. You don't recognize them. That acknowledgement, that's happened. So if they bump into you, they say, machan, and you just ignore them and walk away, then what happens? Then the acknowledgement hasn't happened either. Can you ignore this rupa once it comes in? So rupa comes in, can you go like, don't care. If you can, then try not hearing this. Can you try not hear this, please? Can you? No, you can't. Because you can't ignore. You can't ignore because there's no one to ignore. There's no doer here, only the done, no doer. The whole point of this conversation is what? To get to that end, to understand that there is no doer, because the ego is what makes you think that there is a doer. Got that? The ego is what makes you think that there is a doer, but there is no doer. Just because you think there is a doer doesn't mean there's a doer. In your dreams, don't you think up all sorts of weird and wonderful and fantasies? You know, yeah, ladies in the room, in your dreams, like, aren't you like princesses? in a, you know, married to a rich prince, and then you wake up and you go, ah. How many times have you seen your prince charming, but only in your dreams? And then to wake up and realize that it was nothing but a dream. So those are just fantasies. Why are we talking about fantasies? Where did that come from? Sorry? Just to insult the men. What? There's no doer. Ah, yes, yes. So there's no doer. So when this happens, when an object lands, there's nothing you can do but acknowledge. Just acknowledge. You are not acknowledging it. Acknowledgement happens. See, I can let go of this, but I'm not the one who's dropping it, am I? You might say, drop it. I can't drop it. What if there was no gravity? Can I drop this? If there's no gravity here, the best I can do is what? Let go of it. Then gravity takes over. So who is gravity? He's a king in some faraway land. Or is he a spirit? No, that's just a process. So I can't drop it, can I? So why do you tell your children, why did you drop it? Someone drops a flask, or a vase, the remote, also. Why did you drop it, clumsy fellow? No, they never dropped it, because dropping is not something we can do. Do you think a bird knows that it's dropping it when it drops it? It doesn't even know something's coming out at the other end. It feels a sort of discomfort and it just pushes it out. It doesn't even know it's pushing it out. You know that you're pushing things out because you have studied the human anatomy. You know the body. But a bird, a gecko, do you think it knows I'm going to the toilet now? It doesn't. It feels uncomfortable. Right? It feels uncomfortable and some part of their nervous system they have some control over, and then they just wiggle themselves and then all of a sudden they don't feel a discomfort. And then just carry on with their business. So you can't drop things. This is not dropping. I didn't drop it. All I did was let go. I released. Dropping happened. So next time someone asks you, why did you drop it? What do you say? Wasn't me. Just play that song. So I didn't drop it. All I did was release. I just released. That might have happened accidentally, but I didn't drop it. So they say, why did you break it? There's the other question. But if it drops and then crashes on the floor and it breaks, what's your immediate reaction to that? Look at what you've done. You've broken it. Then remind them. What did Swami Nuance say that day? That we can't break things. We can't drop things. The best we can do is release. That's all I did. Right. Coming back to here. Then, this is the point of acknowledgement. Okay? Vedana is acknowledgement. You can call it registering. I mean, you know, from time to time, I come up with all sorts of weird and wonderful things to, ways to explain this to you. As long as it makes sense to you, I don't care what you call these things. You can call it Romeo and Vanetta and Sally and Sam and whatever you want. Who cares? It's not the names that we need to concern ourselves about. As long as you understand that this is a process and there's no one who's doing this. That's the crux of this. Right then, acknowledgement happens. See, at this point, ladies and gentlemen, now, assume we were, I'm not going to go into that part today. That's for another day, mental note. So here we've acknowledged it. Then, so here's the vipaka that has been received. Here it has been acknowledged. What do we do at this point? So what do you do to the person? You open the door, you acknowledge them, and then you take that mental impression, pass it into your system, get your brain to do stuff and send back a response, right? At that point you go, what? Hey! You say that, right? That's when you recognize. That's recognition. That's when you recognize. Now then, these three things individually can't do much. What we need to do now is to get the combined effect of the vipaka, the acknowledgement, and then the recognition of that. So sankhara, which is this individual here, it's wrong to even say it that way. What happens at this point is the combined effect of these three things. So there's an effect of the vipaka or rupa. There's an effect of acknowledgement and the effect of recognition. Think about it in those terms. You remember the other day we talked about a pair of scissors and how I explained to you that a pair of scissors, why it's called a pair of scissors when there's only one? Because what is there? Two blades and two handles. Yeah? So when a blade and a handle and another blade and a handle, when these two things come into each other's effect fields, this alone has an effect. Alone we would call it a knife, don't we? A blade attached to a handle is called what? A knife. So another blade attached to another handle is called what? Yet another knife. When we bring two knives together in that arrangement and then we bolt it so that they can, what's the word? Rotate around that axis. That's called a pair of scissors. So all that's happened though is one has come into the field of another. So they have kind of moved into each other's, not force fields, but effect fields. You may be familiar with the word force field from Star Wars. But this is not a force field, this is an effect field. Because this has an effect, this has an effect. When you bring the two together, they are now in each other's effect fields. They're called, this is mutually in each other's effect fields. Right? That's exactly what's going on here. So they're in each other's effect fields, and as a result, we have the aggregation of these effects that happen here. That's called sankhara. Once that is done, now you have the final result. So you call it aggregation. And we have the final result, which is perception. A perception. Once it comes to this point, we can now officially say that we are aware. Aware of what? Whatever it is that happened. But see if you can understand this subtle point. Now this will require lots of merit and even more attention. See if you can understand this subtle point. What you have just become aware of. No, start again. This awareness is actually not what happened out there. This awareness is not actually what happened out there. This could be just about anything. I did warn you it was going to be subtle. That's fine. I'll try again. And again and again and again and again until you get it. this awareness is not actually what happened out there. Let's take a simple example. You heard that, right? What you heard, do you think that's what happened here? You heard a what? Sound. Did sound happen here? Then what you heard has no resemblance to what happened here. Do you understand that? It's only your interpretation, or we call a mental interpretation of something, something. We don't know what. Something's happened somewhere. And we have a mental interpretation which we refer to as a sound. But do you see how remote it is from what actually happened? Now, this is going to be even more mind-boggling, what I'm about to say next. It's nice, right, on a Sunday morning to mind-boggle ourselves. Well, that's why you're here. You could have stayed at home and just relaxed Sunday morning. But you want to tax yourself, huh? You come in here. This is going to be even more mind-boggling. It's not really that difficult once you get your head around it. See, when I do this, I do this and I ask you, you captured a sound, you heard a sound, but did the sound happen here? No, right? Okay. But you're looking at me. And you can see Swami Nuhans is bringing his hands together, striking them against each other, and then asking you the question, is it this you heard? That's what I just asked you. I just asked you this question. Is it this you heard? And you say, no, Swami Nuhans, that's not what we heard, because we heard a sound, and we know fully well that sound doesn't happen where you clap your hands, and you're happy with that. So my next question is, then, is this what's happening here as well? You can see something, right? What you're telling me really with the answer to, as the answer to your to my previous question is, we saw you do something, but it's not the sound of that we heard. Once again, Swami Nuhans, we saw you do something, we call it clapping, right? We saw you bring your palms together, I saw with my own two eyes, huh? I saw you clapping, but I understand now that it's not the sound of that we heard, because sound doesn't happen here, it happens only in our minds. Yeah? But as you say that, you're also admitting that you saw me clapping, you saw this, right? And the sound of that is not what you heard. You heard something else, but you saw me doing this. Really? Did you see this? What do you mean by no? Why are you saying no? Exactly. Because sight also happens in the mind. Sound then also happens in the mind. Right? So then, if the sound you heard is not the sound of me doing this, the sight you saw, was that the sight of me doing this? Huh? Was that the sight of me doing this? Then what is this? If the sound is not of me doing this, if the sight is not of me doing this, what else do you know about this? Oh, okay. Right. What are the two things you know about this? Let's go back to basic, what you learned. You know, we are in grade 5 again. Okay, back to grade 5. teacher comes to the front of the class and she says, Lamai, right? Children, and she claps her hands. How do you know that she has clapped her hands? You saw and you heard. So these are the two faculties that help you to become aware that something's going on. And what we think is going on is the teacher clapping her hands. Yeah? Right. Now let's come back to Rajagiri. Grade 5 done, 6 done, 7 done, 8 done, 9 done. Now we're back to Rajagiri. I asked you the question, is this what you heard? You said no. Because sound doesn't happen here. Then I ask, is this what you saw? Is this what you saw? You're saying no. Right? So then, if those are the only two things, sight and sound, the two faculties that you used as evidence to tell me that I clap my hands, if both of these are merely creations of your own mind, then please tell me, how do you know that I did anything at all? How do you know that I did anything at all? Because the... Yeah, of course, the process happens. But why are you convinced that the sight you saw was me clapping my hands? You know, I'm here physically. I'm not there. I'm not in your mind. I'm here physically. We are at least 3 or 4 meters. At least. Everyone else is further than that. So if you're at least 3 or 4 meters, then tell me, I ask the people in the front row, what do you know about me right now as I do this? Am I clapping my hands? Am I creating some sound? Is the sight you're seeing the sight of me doing this? It's nothing to do with what's going on here. All you're seeing and all you're hearing is basically what's going on there. But, you use information you have gathered from the world you live in, knowledge that you have about the various things of physics, spatial arrangement, all of that information you bring in to this experience, and then you say that what you saw was me clapping my hands. Because frankly, you have no idea what I just did right now, or whether I even exist. I'm talking about me, physically me here right now, literally me. You have no idea about me. The only thing you know is what's going on there in your mind, and that is at least 3 meters away from me. The point of this is this. I want you to come to complete understanding that these thoughts that you have, this awareness that you have, is not really an awareness of what's going on in the outside world. It's just an awareness. It's just an awareness. You are deceived by your own awareness. The sound you hear does not originate here. The sight you saw did not originate here. The taste, the smell, the touch does not originate in your food or in any other object for that matter. So what do you know about the outside world? What do you know about anything that is not in your mind? You know absolutely nothing. Your mind is a complete island. Complete island, isolated from everything else. See, you don't see color. You don't hear sounds. You don't smell smells. You don't taste tastes. You don't feel touch. None of these things come from the outside. Your eyes can't see, it's the mind that sees. Your ears can't hear, is the mind that hears. Your tongue can't taste, your body can't feel, and your nose can't smell. But you have them pointing outwards. See, your eyes are pointing this way, your nose is pointing that way, your tongue you can stick out, your arms and legs you have pointing outwards. Yeah? Why do you think they're pointing outwards? They're pointing outwards not to pick up sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, by the way. It's not to pick up sight, sound, smell, taste, or touch. Because these senses, they cannot sense sight, sound, smell, taste, or touch. They are only sensitive to vibrations and shapes. But that also we know because we heard that from someone else. Because, you know, how can you know what your hand actually feels? Because all you know is the touch that you sense. You know, can you feel the smoothness of this surface and then also feel what it actually is like? Like, I mean, do you have... It's a very tricky question. But it's not... I don't mean it to be a tricky question. I just want to try and get the point across to you. You know, your only way to feel things is what? Touch. But if touch is a deception, right? If touch is a deception, how do you know what that actually is? Because the only way to know this is to touch it. And then that's a deception. It's like this, right? Okay. Think about this for a second. You're all allowed one friend. That's all you're allowed, one friend. This friend is blind. Okay? You're all allowed one friend and this friend is blind. The friend goes out and he spends time outside. He or she spends time outside and he comes to you and then relates to you what he or she has experienced. You can see, of course, your eyes are working fine. You can see, you're not blind. But can your friend see? No, because they're blind. So they can only relate to you what they've heard and what they've felt, smelt and tasted. This is all they can report to you. But when they come to you and they relate to you what they have experienced, do you not start forming mental images of what it might look like? You can try this out. Get someone to blindfold you. Get someone to blindfold you at home, not here. And then ask them to put some object. May ideally something you're not all that familiar with. Some object that you're not too familiar with. And then when you start feeling this, you're allowed to feel this object, right? As you feel this object, do you not start having mental images of what it must look like? Yeah? But how? You will say these are from memories and previous experience, you know, something that that feels like this, looked like that. You know, you're just going by previous experience and memory here. But can you have any confidence at all that what you're feeling actually looks like what you think it is? No, because but that doesn't stop you from forming a mental image, does it? If you are blindfolded and you are asked to touch something and you feel it and you're supposed to say what it is. Yeah? Then in your mind you're already, and you can even give a color, can't you? I'll tell you one place where this actually happens. If I told you I'm going to get you pizza now, I we are going to get you all pizza. Right? Even before it arrives. Don't you have a mental image of what it looks like? You might be thinking of a pizza that you had in the past, but that is not the pizza that I'm going to give you. You've never seen this pizza that I'm talking about. So the mental image that you form in your mind, is that the actual pizza? Because you haven't seen it. So as a blindfolded person, when you feel something and you have this mental image of what it is, you have a mental image, is that the actual image of what the object is? No, because you are now deprived of the faculty of sight. Right? Do you understand then that whatever mental image you have is a pure mental concoction? And it could, and nothing could be more remote from the actual object. Yeah? That's exactly what's going on throughout this process. That analogy is a perfect fit for what's going on throughout this process. You're taking in mental impressions of the world, ladies and gentlemen, with absolutely no idea as to what's going on outside there. Everything here is actually fake. The colors you see are fake. The sounds you hear are fake. The tastes you experience are fake. The smells, they are fake. The physical experiences, they are fake. Is this rough or smooth? You think this smoothness exists in this pen? If you took a pin and pressed it against your finger, you'd feel pain, right? Yeah? This causes no pain at all. This physical action, trust me, causes no pain at all. Here, there is no pain. In this zone, there's no pain. Pain is only a mental impression. Pain is a purely mental impression. But pain does not exist in the real world, outside world. By real world, I mean the outside world. There's no pain in the outside world. Why do you think your body has then, your mind has come up with this very unpleasant experience of pain? I mean, why pain? Why is it that when you stick a needle into your finger, you just don't see yellow or something? Wouldn't that be nice? Instead of pain, you see yellow. Wouldn't that be nice? Because if yellow is a mental impression and pain is a mental impression, why go for pain? Do you get my point? Hello? Yes? Why don't we just, you light this up and you hold your finger out there and you taste mangoes. Because if mangoes are also, the taste of mango is also a mental impression, and if pain is also a mental impression, why were we not designed that way? There's a reason for that. There's a very interesting reason for that. This is the same reason why exercise hurts, but eating doesn't. Eating. Which one is the unpleasant experience? Consuming 500 calories or burning 500 calories? Why is it that way? Why could it not be the other way? If it were the other way, wouldn't you be fitter, healthier? If consuming 500 calories was as painful as burning it, exercising 500 calories, wouldn't we all be fitter and healthier? So why were we designed that way? Whose practical joke was that? No one else's but yours. You did this to yourselves. Let me explain to you why. You did this to yourselves, and you designed your minds to be this way. And here's the reason for that. E-G-O. Ego. Ego is why you feel pain. At face value, you might completely deny this. Swami, what are you talking about? How can ego be the cause for pain? Well, let me explain. Ego is your mind's attempt. Is your mind's attempt to separate. To separate. Don't you feel separate from each other? That is your ego at work. That's your ego at large. The fact that you feel you're separate entities to each other is your ego at play. Okay? Do you not see how when this separation is the be-all and end-all of a process, pain plays a very critical and crucial role? How so? When you want to separate, the mind goes to work at separating energy. Because energy is all that exists in this universe. Nothing more, nothing less. This is energy, this is energy, this is energy, and so is this. All of this is energy. So if you wanted to separate something, the only thing there is to separate is what? Energy. Right? Ego is the identification of that separation. When you separate something and then you identify it, that's what ego does. Now do you see? These bodies that you are, they're not really bodies. This is just separated energy. What is it that you have brought here, sir? Your body? No. This is just separated energy. You think it's separated, but it's not really. That's why you can throw it back into the environment, and the environment will, no sooner than you throw it in there, it will start taking it in. But right now, you won't let it decay. Because this is you, so you think. Then, when you believe that this is you, but in truth, it's only separated energy, must you not have a mechanism within yourself to prevent the decay of that energy? Must you not have a mechanism within yourself, self-designed, to prevent the decay of that energy, the dissipation of that energy, so that that energy, that which you identify as you, can be kept in one lump that you are? Must you not have a mechanism for that? What is that mechanism called? It's called pain. That mechanism is called pain. That's why if you do something to this lump of energy, which results in the decay or the dissipation of that energy, your mind will immediately sense pain to prevent it from happening. That's why eating 500 calories doesn't hurt. Because what do you do when you eat? You add more energy into this lump. Isn't it? You're just accumulating more energy, meaning separating more energy. Because what does the mind want? The ego want? Not the mind. What does the ego want? Separation. So because the ego wants separation and energy is all there is to separate, that's an important point, right? Because the mind, sorry, not the mind, ego wants separation and energy is all there is to separate, putting energy into this lump does not hurt. It's not designed that way. But the moment you start to take energy out of this lump, what happens then? Now there's an internal self-defense mechanism that is called pain to prevent that from happening. That's why walking hurts. Running hurts even more. Running while jumping, that hurts even more. Lifting weights hurts. Climbing a mountain hurts. Exercise hurts. What is work after all? The release of energy. That hurts. What doesn't hurt? Accumulating energy. So you could sit on your bed and eat and eat and eat all day long. Would it hurt? Not in the way that I mean, but you know, you understand that it hurts, right? It hurts your body. I mean, as in it's bad for your health. But remember, then this is also a very interesting and important point to understand. Why does your mind let your body do something that is harmful to it in the long run? Think about that for a second. Why does your mind let you consume all these calories knowing fully well, even when you know, even people who know, I mean, dietitians I've seen, sometimes even doctors, right, they've gone to the pinnacle of their careers, but you should look at the size of them. Not insulting the doctor themselves, but you got to understand, you know, sometimes they can't stop themselves from eating. But they will go around advising people to be careful with what they eat, watch their diet, but when it comes to them, different rules. Why doesn't the mind stop the intake of calories when it knows that it's bad for the body? That's not the mind. That's ego. The mind loves the body, not the ego. Your mind will care about the body because it's natural. The mind is natural and the body is natural. They were both gifts of God. Both mind and body are gifts of God, not ego. Hey, the ego even harms the mind. What talk about the body? What is there to talk about the body? Doesn't your ego cause you to binge watch TV, movies? Doesn't your ego cause you to do things that you know will cause you harm, damage, wound you, hurt you? It's your ego that does that. Do you understand that the ego is an external enemy? I say external, by which I mean it's not part of you. It's a disease. The ego is a disease. The ego doesn't care about the mind and neither does it care about the body. Therefore, for as long as you live with it, you will remain hijacked. You shall remain hijacked by your ego. You have been hijacked. Your ego has hijacked you. This is you. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana, that is you. Not ego. When this happens, ego creeps in and it takes over the entire process. It hijacks the process. And then what was meant to be mere awareness, mere consciousness, now, thanks to ego, goes from just being an awareness to there is someone who is aware. Be aware of this for a second. This pen. Tell me, is it mere awareness that you feel, or isn't there someone who's aware of this? Don't you feel a someone in you who's aware of this? That is the ego part. But the awareness part, that is very harmless. That is harmless. The you feeling that there is someone there who is aware of this, that Nothing could be more harmful than that. Fine. I'm quite happy to leave the sermon there for today. I hope you will walk away today having distinguished these two elements, that there is awareness, but not someone who is aware. That there is, but that's not natural. That is what we need to understand as our ego. And that ego is the cause of all that suffering that I spoke about earlier. How you become the victim of scaremongering, how you become the victim of extremism, and how people can put in these ideas about nationalism and racialism and religion and get you to identify as an individual who is of a certain nationality, of a certain religion, of a certain race. And therefore, when that becomes part of your identity, it becomes your sole purpose of existence to fight for that. And in the process of that, you sacrifice your mind and body. You don't sacrifice your ego. That's the dirtiest thing about ego. It claims war. It calls for war. Like, you know, the kings in the day, back in the day, kings, when there was a war, when they declared war, they were out on the battlefield. Have you seen these movies? That's how they used to be. They were out in the battlefield. They used to be at the forefront of the battle. But kings of today, when there's a war, where are they? They're in a room somewhere, locked with all safety and protection and everything to make sure that they are safe, right? But the soldiers go out to war. But back in those days, the king on his horse, he was at the forefront. He was out there fighting on the forefront, right? Akin to what's happening nowadays, where it's only the soldiers out on the field, but not the kings. Similar to that, this is what ego does. Ego will sacrifice mind and body. So minds end up being corrupted, bodies end up being wasted. But ego survives. And ego thrives. Birth after birth after birth after birth. Ego thrives. But every time, mind and body corrupted. In the lowest of animal forms, there's an ego. In the highest of the devas, there's an ego. Forever, wherever there is existence, there's an ego. Minds and bodies being wasted, used, exploited, abused, but ego foe shall ever survive. If you can see the problem here, then it's time that you stood up to fight the enemy within you. So let those wars, let the people who perpetrate that, let them do that. Don't make that your problem. You have much bigger fish to fry. When there's no peace at home, when there's no peace at heart, what's the point in tuning your television sets and your radios and buying the newspapers and going on social media to find out how people are warring with each other and other countries? So my invitation to you is, don't bring that rubbish again into your homes. Create a paradise of loving kindness and compassion in your homes. That is how we create a monastery. The monastery is not the shrine room. It's not the pagoda. It's not the Buddha statues. It's not the dharmashala. It's not the satapenavasa. It's none of these things. What is it? It's the compassion, the loving kindness, the generosity that lay in the hearts of the people who lay foot in that holy precinct. That is what makes it a monastery. So you can do the same at home. Don't bring the war home. Do you understand? The world needs to be healed. Where do you start? Right with him.
This is where healing starts. Here I have explained to you the depths of what I talked about. At the beginning of this talk, I talked to you about the surface. Here's under the bonnet, and here is in the car. Nice and comfortable. So I've shown you both sides of this picture. And one last thing I ask you to do. I'm saying this again in case you forget. Three people I said, when you hand something over to, do it with both hands. Who's that? Teachers, mother, and father. If they're still alive, do it until their last moment. Whether it's their medicine, whether it's a glass of water, whether it's the broom, doesn't matter. Whether it's their meal, do it with both hands. Not for their benefit, but for yours. I have a small request to make. From all of you, we are all very privileged to use this space at the school for no cost at all. It has always been like that from the day we started these programs. You know, the management, they do it for their own merit. That is why they are wise. That if they did it purely as a convenience for you, then I would have a word with them and tell them, yeah, that is good. That is how we benefit from it. But you must understand that what comes out of this is also merit for your own salvation. So two parties have to benefit from every transaction we do. Yeah? I come here and do the sermon. Take me as an example. I give you the Dhamma, but does it leave me empty? Sabbadanam Dhammadanam Jinati. I know that. The supreme of all, what is supreme of all giving is the giving of the Dhamma. So that I need for my journey to my own salvation. So that is that. When you offer me alms at the end, is it merely just to fill my stomach? Or do you wish for something out of that as well? You do, and you must. Expect Nibbana, nothing more than that. So the school management do the same, and they have been doing it for the last so many months and years. There's a small thing that we sometimes tend to do because we forget. And we are humans, we always forget things. That causes them a slight inconvenience. So something I have observed, and when I observed, I asked our Anagarika Mahathyas to make an observation, and then I asked them, I've noticed something like this, and how does it affect you? So at that point, they took the opportunity that I offered to them and informed me, well, as you asked, Swami answered, there is a slight inconvenience in the way that the arrangements are done at the end, sorry, when you come in here. And so I said, well, if you don't mind, I will announce it to our Rajagirians so that they are aware of this. Right? So this matter is simply to do with the use of space outside the school, outside the school, within the school premises. So I have with me a couple of points that I would like for all of us to remember. Try and remember to the best of your ability. I know that you will forget again. Just like the phone. You will forget. And then when you forget, what do? You remind again. Right? None of this is going to be written in stone because we are not stone. And they understand that. But from time to time, I will remind you of this. And you do try your best to try and comply with this because it will mean that the management at the school are as least inconvenienced as possible. So here are a couple of things. All vehicles are kindly requested to be parked only in the designated rear car park. Do you know where the rear car park is? It's at the rear. So if you have newcomers, then kindly point it to them, show it to them, make sure that they are... I don't need to teach this stuff to you. You look after your people anyway. I don't need to teach you how to suck eggs. You know how to do that. But when we park our vehicles, let's make sure that our vehicles are only parked in the rear car park.
What's most important, ladies and gentlemen, is that we don't park our cars near the basketball court. Because usually there are events that are going on, children come in and, you know, these are our children, they're all our children, aren't they? So we have to give them the space and the peace of mind to do what they have to do. Because when there are vehicles moving here and there, there's always a risk. And then parents get worried and they get, you know, they're concerned. Just like you, they're also parents, they get concerned. So when children are playing and their vehicles going here and there, it can be a problem. So the best thing to do is let's avoid the parking in the basketball courts. You will see that there are some vehicles there that will typically be the school's vehicles. So they have a policy for that. Let them do that. But the ask from us, all of us, is that we just don't park our vehicles there. Now, they have been ever so kind to grant Swami Mohanse's car to come up and park within the car park around here. And I even said, you know, please, if that's an inconvenience, we are quite happy to park. I'll walk. My legs are, for as long as my legs will carry me, I'm quite comfortable to do that. And then they completely refused it. I said, well, what if they dropped Swami Mohanse here and then went and parked the car outside and still it was a refusal? So Swami Mohanse's car is parked here. If you want to park your car here, you become a Swami Mohanse. Then it's okay, right? See, though, there is a way to park your car in the car park. So if you really want to park your car in the car park, you come and meet me after the sermon. There will be those among you who come into the school in three-wheeler. For historical reasons, where some problems had happened a long time ago, the school management had at one point made a decision not to allow three-wheelers to come in past the main gate. So I think it's only right we honor that and respect the policy that has been placed there. I think there's a board outside the gate that says, please don't bring three-wheelers in. It's not that three-wheel drivers are bad or people who come in three-wheelers are bad. No one's bad, everyone's good, right? No one's bad. But there's a policy that has been made for whatever reason. It's not for us to question why, what, when, how, right? It's not for that, for us to do that. If that is a request that has been made, then we just comply with that. So when you come in a three-wheeler, just get off, please get off at the gate and you know, pay your rickshaw driver, but don't invite him or her into the school premises. If there's anyone, see, they've even gone as far as they wanted me to mention this specifically and this particularly. So I said, well, I'll ask everyone to park outside as a reminder. And then, you know what they said? But Swami Mohanse, sir, what if there's someone who finds it difficult to walk from the car park? I was amazed. I said, I will ask everyone to park outside in the car park and let's call it a day. And they said, no, but Swami Mohanse, what if there are people who find it difficult to walk from the car park to here? So I said, okay, what do you want to do then? Then they said, okay, Swami Mohanse, can we arrange so that the car can still come in past the barricade, drop the respective individual, and then the car to be parked in the car park? I said, are you sure? I said, yes. So then let's adhere to that. And one final request, you will see that there are traffic cones placed in places. So they're not toys. And they're not there to take home with you. Not that anyone has done. But sometimes you might be tempted to move them. And when it says don't park here, if you move the cone, then you can park, right? See, why do you have to go through all that trouble when there's a simple way to find parking within the, you know, within the basketball, inside the basketball car park? All you have to do is ordain, right? So simple. Or at least become an anagarika. Simple. You don't have to pick up the cones and move them here and there. Yeah? So my request is then, if there are cones laid out in certain places, they are there because they have to be there, not where you think they have to be. So shall we kindly not move those cones, what it means is it's a restricted area. Okay? So, despite many requests from me to... despite many requests from them to not make a deal or a fuss out of it, in fact, they said, Nani Swami Nasa, I don't want you to say this out to people. It's not that big an issue, whatever. I said, no, it's fine. I will say it. And now people are more than willing to comply. And, you know, this is their place as much as it is anybody's. You know, this is a second home for us in some ways. Here's where we learn the Dhamma. And so this is a temple. So when we come to the temple, there's a way in which we conduct ourselves. So if we can all just comply with those humble requests, I think we can make this a very comfortable place, not just for ourselves, but also for the security officials as well, because they have a job to do and we must not make it difficult for them. As I've taken the effort to say all that, I will leave you with this. I don't know whether I shared this with you once before, but I'll say it again because it's a very interesting and important lesson that I took at some point in my life. There are three ways in which we can leave a place. Did I share it with you? No. I will remind for those who were not here. There are three ways in which we can leave a place. Number one, when you walk into a place, you can leave it better than you found it. Yeah, you can leave it better than you found it. If you can't do that, what must you do? We have number two. Leave it as you found it. Leave it as you found it. Only if you can't do number one, which is to leave it better than you found it. But if you can't leave it as you found it, what's the third way? To leave it worse than you found it. There's something better than that. Don't go there in the first place. So actually there are only two ways to leave a place. Either better than you found it, as you found it. The third is not a way to leave that place. Just don't go there in the first place. Because it is better for not having you in there. So this is a lesson I teach myself and I remind myself. That's why when we are done with the sermon, we have a habit of wiping the whiteboard. Because when I came in here, it was blank and it was usable. But now I've made it worse. I can't leave it better than I found it, but at least I can leave it as I found it. If I stood away and walked away now, I have left it worse than I found it. Because the next person who comes to use it has to erase it before they can use it. See, something as simple as that. When you get up and leave, if your chair is crooked, now you know fully well that they are going to come and clear the chairs away. But that don't make that your concern. If your chair is not straight, straighten it. 10 minutes after you left this room, maybe they'll come and put the chairs back and, you know, arrange the hall for something else. But that's not our concern. If when I walked into this room, the chair was kept straight in like a certain tile, like it was aligned to that in that way, leave it as it is. Leave it how you found it. You can always ask, shall we clear the chairs? If that's what you want. And if they say yes, if you can help with that, now you're leaving it better than you found it. But if you can't do that, leave it as you found it, but don't leave it. Don't leave it. Don't leave it worse. These are good attitudes to have in our lives. It will take us a long way. Good manners are always made up of petty sacrifices. Nothing more than that. It's very important to be people of good manners. Not that you don't. You have all the good manners and more. But it's something we must always remind ourselves. Petty sacrifices, that's all, nothing more than that. People appreciate those things. Right, let's leave it there then. Okay, let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma, inviting the Swami Master to deliver the sermon, as well as making everyone feel comfortable and providing each other with hospitality and helping them feel at home and ensuring the right mindset so that they are able to listen to the teaching and comprehend the Dhamma. First and foremost, let us transfer this message to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas throughout the world who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed them down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the monks and nuns residing in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine, as well as the Mahanayakas, Yanunayakas of all the chapters who have dedicated their lives to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the other monks resident of the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer this message to our devotees and friends of the monastery who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicine, as well as provide your know-how and well wishes. Let us also transfer this message to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who's helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. With an abundance of compassion and loving kindness towards all of them, let us transfer these merits to them. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, loved ones who have passed away in our names, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us transfer this message to those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends of ours, siblings of ours, and so on. Therefore, with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness, and a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us, let us transfer these merits to all of them. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success become arahatan vahanse or an arahat teranin vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The Mahasangha will transfer the blessings to you. Raga gindin midhva dvesha gindin midhva moha gindin midhva nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita tarvetva nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita tarvetva mamadasya lulokasya
satmayo nibbana parama sukhayam sukhita tarvitva nibbana parama sukhayam sukhita tarvitva nibbana parama sukhayam sukhita tarvitva raga vini niveva dvesha vini niveva moha vini niveva nivansata veva nivansata அனந்த மகாகுணபலின் சீலு லோக சீலு சத்துவ நிபான பரமசுக்கை சுகுதி தலைவத்வா சாது சாது சாது.